This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, then give us a call now at 1-800-462-7413. And as per usual, some topics to talk over during the hour.
Yes, we're happiest on the weekends. I know that shocks you. I know that you think the weekends are a bad time, but why are we happiest on the weekends? That is interesting.
We have some research about that.
Yes, we've got some good research.
What else? Side
effects of going into the hospital, infections, rehospitalizations, great big issue, financial issue, but an issue for your health and the health of anyone who is going to be hospitalized.
Sounds interesting and important. That's coming up. What's our recipe?
Southwestern Salmon Burgers. We'll talk about not just salmon, one of my favorites, if not my favorite fish, but we'll talk about what is unique about this recipe. Southwestern Salmon Burgers, fabulous.
That's coming up from a guest chef later on in the program. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. Let's get to the phone, Zorba. A listener with us now in Madison, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hi there.
How can we help?
Well, so I have a twin sister who smokes really heavily, mm-hmm. and I'd like to help her quit. So she has tried the patches, but she has really sensitive skin, and so they itch. She's tried the gum, but she feels she has to chew so much of the gum to get over her, like, nicotine craving. She, like, in her own words, feels like she's going to get locked up. So I've talked to her, and she's interested in the lozenges, the inhalers, in prescriptions, but she doesn't have health insurance, so I was going to try to help her monetarily, but I have no idea what to pick. I don't know the pros and cons of the methods with nicotine, without nicotine, the kinds that are inhalers, and should I be, like, looking really hard into figuring out a way to get counseling for her? I don't know what the best...
Interesting. It's a great idea. I had never thought about this, but it's sort of like walking into a supermarket and seeing a bunch of things on the shelves and you don't know where to start. It used to be that we had nothing, so where to start meant nothing. But now we have lots of different variations, although they actually fit nicely into three categories. So category one is counseling. That's category one. Now, counseling is great. It's awesome. It's a very important part of any stop smoking program. Every state has basically an 800 number that you can call for counseling. So the state of Texas has it. The state of Wisconsin has it. If you Google it, we'll put it on our website, which is zorbapastor.org. We'll give you the 800 number for the state of Wisconsin. And frankly, they'll counsel anybody with that. They're paid for out of state dollars, and we'll put that number up on the website. So the counseling is important because it gives you tips. There are behavioral tips of what to do. Where do you put candy? What about the tips of when you want to smoke? Often it means a break. So how do you take your break without doing it? 20 minutes of counseling immediately increases your chances, almost doubles the chances of success. So then, what else do we have? We have nicotine replacement and we have drugs. Okay, so nicotine replacement, let's look at it. What are the different kinds? They're all just putting nicotine into your bloodstream, right? So the patch makes her itch, so the glue on the patch is bad for her?
That's right, yeah. She's tried a couple different brands, but...
Okay, so she has sensitive skin, doesn't like the patch, and the gum makes her feel like she is chewing forever. I can kind of picture that, like I've got to just chew the gum. And once again, these are over-the-counter, but there are nicotine lozenges, there are nicotine inhalers that you can also use. Those are really the two other issues. They are by prescription, so they're more expensive. I don't know what the price is, but you call up your doctor and you say, look, I want to get some nicotine lozenges or inhalers, or if you know somebody who is a physician friend, there is no problem in giving it to somebody else. I mean, on the whole, I say don't give prescription drugs to somebody else, but this is nicotine replacement. It ought to be over the counter as it is. Why haven't the feds made it over the counter? I don't know. So we've got nicotine replacement. The third thing are the pills. Bupropion, an antidepressant, is a generic, and it's much cheaper than Chantix, which is very expensive. We're talking about $100 or $200 a month. So bupropion, 150 milligrams twice daily. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. It doubles the chances of smoking. So counseling, Nicotine replacement is a lozenge. Bupropion for that. All three will double or triple her chances of success.
Yeah. Another thing that helps her chances of success is that she actually wants to quit. So, you know, she has asked for help.
Oh, no, no, absolutely. Tom, you bring up a really good point. If you're not motivated, nothing works.
Right.
And I tell people, if you're not ready to quit, don't even bother spending the money. Get yourself ready to quit. And when you're ready to quit, use these aids. They are not crutches. They are aids to help you quit. The average person takes four tries before they kick the habit, mm-hmm. kick the butt.
Thank you so much for calling. 1-800-462-7413. Back to the phone, Zorba, and a listener in Knoxville, Tennessee now. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba.
What's up?
Well, I just basically would like a little bit of insight into the effects of caffeine and alcohol on high blood pressure. I'm a 32-year-old, pretty fit male, mm-hmm. And I don't have any bad vices. I don't eat fast food. I don't use tobacco. I don't drink a lot. I do enjoy a good, strong cup of coffee many times a day, but I don't drink anything but a glass of wine an evening. But I do have pre-hypertensive stages of high blood pressure. So I'm just kind of curious as to your insight.
Well, Zorba will never tell you to stop drinking coffee.
Not in the least.
Right.
Not in the least. But let's look at where the hard data is. The hard data are in two different things. Number one, salt. 20 to 25% of the people are salt sensitive. Now, there's a movement to reduce salt in America because we have too much salt in our food. There's a theory that that salt causes high blood pressure. It is not founded. It is only a theory, and it's been a theory for 30 or 40 years. So we don't really know. However, we know that 20 to 25% of the people are salt sensitive. So reducing salt in your diet is the first thing you can see whether or not it reduces your high blood pressure. So you go to a diet that has very little salt, nothing prepackaged. You make the food yourself. You reduce the salt, only salt the top of your food, no salt in cooking. See what it does. Very simple.
Right.
Buy a machine, measure your blood pressure at home. Buy a good machine that costs, you know, $50 to $75. That's what I would recommend. And there are a couple of machines that I recommend. We'll put them on the website, zorbapastor.org. So I'll give you an
Great.
Example of a machine that I think is a company that produces a very good machine. Now, alcohol. We know that people who drink basically 3 to 4 drinks a day have high, you know, who have high blood pressure. Alcohol's the culprit. We know that when you stop alcohol in alcoholics, often their pressure goes down. So 1 to 2 drinks a day, 1 drink a day for women, 2 for men, has to do with how they metabolize. It also reduces that. Now, weight loss is number 3. We know people who are overweight who lose 10 pounds may control their blood pressure. Number 4 is exercise. Independent of weight loss, people exercise more, make their body healthier, may reduce their blood pressure. So those are the things that you can go from a pre-high blood pressure state to basically a normal state where you won't need medications. But I caution you, get your pressure measured, and if it remains high and if you have pre-high blood pressure and you're over the age of 40 or 45, you have any other risk factors for heart disease, take pills. Because the number one thing we've done is reduce stroke by 70% in the last 3 decades, and that's because we aggressively treat high blood pressure. 70% is great. I mean, when you look at the cancer versus the stroke statistics, we are awesome when it comes to stroke. We are really miserable when it comes from cancer. We have earlier detection, but when we look at people who have cancer and it's spread, we don't do a very good job. Mm-hmm. You know, despite the fact that we've said we've made great strides, it's only been with childhood lymphoma and leukemia, we've made great strides with really surgical removal of early tumors, but when it comes to the drugs for cancer, not nearly as good as for high blood pressure. So if you need high blood pressure pills, take them. But I try those behavioral things first.
I sure will. Well,
good luck.
Thank you
and
very
drink
much.
And coffee. Drink it. Enjoy it. It's not a sin. It's not a sin. It's good for you. It reduces the risk of diabetes, and there's good research for that.
Yeah.
And it makes you stay on task so you are not likely to have a car accident when you're driving down the
road. And it's really easy to do. You just take a spoon and take it out of the jar and put it in the
cup. Oh, gosh, not at all. No instant coffee. None of the least. Stay away from that stuff. It's garbage. It'll kill you.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you.
800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, somebody really did some research on why we're happier on the weekend than we are during the week.
Shocking, isn't it?
Yeah,
I know.
I've always wondered about that.
But the question is why? Now, is it just the reduction of work? I mean, like, I'm not working, I'm happier on the weekend. Is that what it is? So this was a study looking at, it was human motivation research. It is the Center for Human Motivation Research. What motivates humans?
Yeah.
What motivates guys?
Let's get back.
That's
to,
another story.
Let's get back to the weekend.
What motivates guys? And what motivates women? Well, that's another story, too. Yeah. But they were looking at men and women from the age of around 18 to their early 60s. They worked at least 30 hours a week, and they looked to see what they were doing that made them happy. And they carried a pager with them. It was a pager with them, and they would be randomly paged 3 times a day. And when they were paged, they had to write down the activity they were engaged in and then grade it. So during the weekend, because we know people are happier on the weekend, and they were basically gathering data over the weekend to find out what made people happy, and they had to write some things. And it was very interesting. They looked at what made them happier, and it was a number of things. It was greater competency in what they were doing on the weekends.
Greater competency.
Mm-hmm. There's a competency issue. Like, I'm cleaning the house and I feel good about cleaning the house. I'm competent to do it.
They're bad at their jobs?
Well, it's just greater competency. I'm just telling you what it doesn't mean that they're incompetent. A greater competence. They had feelings of autonomy. They could do what they wanted to do.
I get that. Nobody's bossing them around.
Well, yeah. Well, it depends on what house you're in.
Except the spouse.
Come on. Nobody's bossing them around. What about the honey-do list? I mean, do you feel autonomous on the weekends?
I feel autonomous.
Right. No, but on the weekends, there's the honey-do list. Relatedness to other people. Relatedness to other people was the other aspect. They were with other people in a social venue. And so when we grade it, we look at it together, it was the social venue of the weekend that came out number one. It was autonomy, number two. They could make the decision of what they wanted to do, whether, you know, like you say, there may be a honey-do list, but they can do it. And it was feeling competent at what they were doing. They had a greater sense of competency. And that's why we're happy on the weekends. I knew you've been wondering about this your entire life, but that's why we're happy on the weekends.
I don't buy any of that. It seems to me that the reason we're happy, what you said earlier, we aren't working.
Well,
we aren't at work.
Yes.
I mean, the social stuff.
Yeah, well, wait a second.
Most people have social stuff at work that they...
Yeah. Well, that is true. That is true. So you don't buy it at all.
I don't buy it at all.
All right. Here we go. Toss it.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Here's a listener in Jacksonville Beach, Florida now. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I'm the proud grandmother of a 6-month-old baby boy, and my poor daughter and son-in-law are not sleeping at night. And she's doing all the right things, nursing, you know, breastfeeding, but he keeps waking up every hour at night when he goes to bed. And crying. Sometimes he wants to nurse, sometimes he doesn't. So we're just concerned that maybe he's an insomniac already at 6 months, or there may be something wrong, or maybe there's something that she can do so they can get some sleep.
Hmm. Well, now you're a grandma.
I'm a grandma.
So you've been through this. Can't you just give her the right advice and solve her problems?
Well, I was lucky because both my girls slept through the night. It was amazing. And I don't know how I did it. And now I'm too old to remember. So.
Well, my old friend and mentor, Bob Mendelsohn, used to say, one grandmother is worth 2 pediatricians. That's the equation. But yeah, a lot of times we don't remember exactly these things. So let's look back to it. What advice have you given? Obviously, you've given advice. You're the grandma. So you've given advice.
Well, I thought maybe he was sleeping too much during the daytime.
Good advice.
And she said, no, he doesn't sleep, you know, maybe he has one nap or two and only for 30 minutes or 1 hour.
Uh-huh.
So I started getting concerned as well because I thought, well, doesn't a baby need about 12 hours sleep?
Well, the baby is not an insomniac. Let's put that to rest right away. They're insomniacs because they're awake.
Yeah.
They're awake all evening. So I'm going to give some advice, and we're going to get emails on the advice.
Okay.
And the reason is there's no science behind it. And so you look around and you see what works for you. And it's a style issue. It's a style issue. So first of all, we know getting up every hour is not good for mom and dad, right? So we know that right away. And so sometimes we have to take assertive action. And assertive action can mean moving the baby into the other room and living with the crying, making sure that your child is safe and protected and fed, putting the child to sleep at a time that you know that, you know, baby's okay and it's well fed, it's warm, it's clothed, it's safe, it's in the other room, and you really don't respond for 3 hours. That's what you do. And babies cry. And a crying is a very, I don't want to say it's a nonspecific response because it isn't, but it's a response that means a whole bunch of things. Babies cry not only because they're hungry, because they want to be next to you. And it's not that they want to be next to you, but they want to also interact with you. And you want to be, and they want to be nurtured by you. And so obviously the family is not happy once an hour. There's some families who will say, I'm dedicated to my child. Once an hour is okay with me. I'm just not going to get much sleep and I'm going to grab a catnip when I can. But other families like yours are saying more. So
you're saying maybe try just letting him cry himself to sleep.
Absolutely. And do that and look at it and move it from 1 hour to 2 hours and you look at it on the clock and it's very tough. It's tough to be in that other room. And if you want to, you can peek in. As long as your baby doesn't see you, you can peek into that room and see. But I think you should move the baby out of the room into another room and not respond. Move it from 1 hour to 2 hours. And then when that works, move it from 2 hours to 3 hours. And your baby over time will then start to get into a deeper sleep. And when it turns over, it's not going to necessarily say, hey, mom, come and talk to me. Hey, dad, I'm here. Because it's a very, there are lots of things that are going on with crying. There are a lot of things that are going on with your baby. Now, it's a style issue. If that style doesn't fit them, then they're just going to have to live with it until basically the baby starts to develop, you know, a more steady sleep pattern. So it's a style issue. It's a function of what you want to do. Other people say, no, that's terrible. That's awful. You find a style that fits you. I am the daddy of four children. Our children did not sleep through the night until they were about basically, I think, a year and a half old, something like that. But we moved them to an every 3 hour cycle, 3 to 4 hour cycle. Our good friends, their baby slept through the night. Our best friends, they slept through the night at 6 months. We were ready, well, really about 6 weeks. We were ready to shoot them because they said, our baby sleeps through the night, your baby doesn't. What's wrong? Well, I don't know. You know, they're just different patterns. And all of our children sleep through the night now. Nobody gets up every hour. So good luck, Grandma.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy those six-month-olds. They're great kids.
Before the break, Zorba, time now to don your black robe and dust off your gavel because we have another case for Judge Zorba.
I love it.
Today's case is from Julia in Norman, Oklahoma, and centers around recess for elementary school. She explains, the public school system in our city in Oklahoma has a policy that elementary-age children are not allowed outdoors for recess if the temperature or wind chill is 32 degrees or below. They've also eliminated the second recess, so there's only one. What's worse, during recess, the kids often sit and do puzzles in their classroom since the gymnasium is otherwise in use. Could you help me round up evidence to convince the school district that it's not unsafe for kids to be outside at 32 and below? In fact, that they need daily vigorous outdoor exercise and the vitamin D from the sun. Zorba, how do you rule in Julia v. Oklahoma School Board?
Absolutely on the side of you. Get those kids out of the classroom and outside moving around. Now, the vitamin D, you don't get much vitamin D. I mean, you get it from milk and you get it from vitamins, but frankly, you're not going to get much in the wintertime. But hey, the data's right there. All you have to do is get them on a plane and bring them to the state of Wisconsin during recess, and they can see how those kids get out there and move around. You know, I mean, the reality is kids need good activities to move their bodies. They don't need puzzles.
Right.
What you're doing is you're encouraging laziness, slothfulness, obesity, and saying, hey, a puzzle is the same as outside. What are we teaching our kids? We're teaching them that sitting down and moving their hands a little bit is the same as running outside and taking a break in the middle of the day. I think it's quite the contrary. I think we all need recess. I think everyone should stop what they're doing from 10 o'clock to 10:15, go outside of their buildings and move around.
But what if it's like 0 degrees.
Well, I think, we're talking 32 degrees. I mean,
or below.
I don't think it's 32 or below. I think you have to look down and say, what is the lowest number where you can find data? And it's probably about 10 degrees or 15 mm-hmm. degrees. It's mm-hmm. not 32 degrees, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Where's the line? It ain't at 32.
Okay, want to add your case to Judge Zorba's docket? Send your affidavit or email to
Zorba@WPR.org, or maybe we should say Judge Zorba.
Maybe we should. We have our recipe coming up, Chef Zorba, actually a guest chef with a recipe coming up. More of your calls, some interesting research to talk about, and our medical myth buster later on this hour here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have an open line for you if you'd like to join us. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. But before we get back to the phones, it's recipe time now, Zorba, and we have a special guest chef joining us today. Would you please welcome Alana Amsterdam, author of the Gluten-Free Almond Flour Cookbook. Alana's cookbook is tailored to those on a restricted gluten-free diet, but can be enjoyed by all. That's because, unlike other gluten-free foods, the recipes in Alana's book don't have an unappetizing taste and texture of cardboard. They are easy to make and packed with fiber, protein, antioxidants, and the good fats, perfect for anyone interested in healthy eating. So, without further delay, here is the recipe for Southwestern Salmon Burgers as featured in the Gluten-Free Almond Flour Cookbook by Alana Amsterdam. You know, Alana, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, good. You know, Tom just brought up such an interesting point, you know, having something that actually tastes good, because often when we remove something from our diet, people go, oh, wait a minute, it's not going to taste very good at all. I don't want to remove that. It's going to be cardboard. And often when I've looked at gluten-free recipes, they do appear to be unappetizing. They're not the most appetizing thing. How'd you get into this?
Well, I was diagnosed with celiac disease in 1998, and so I was just kind of moving along, making separate gluten-free food for myself. And then my son was diagnosed when he was 3 years old in 2001. And I really made it my mission to turn all of my favorite classic recipes from childhood into delicious gluten-free versions. Because I wanted him to be able to have chocolate chip cookies and chicken parmesan and all those yummy things I grew up with in a gluten-free and healthier version.
And all of this is in the cookbook. Let's get to our recipe.
All in the cookbook.
Southwestern Salmon Burgers.
You know, I love salmon. Salmon is my favorite fish overall, and I love it obviously because it's good for you. It's got mm-hmm. good fats, omega-3 fatty acids. Salmon is your favorite fish? Is that what you like, or what fish do you like?
I actually like salmon the best. I just think it has a wonderful flavor, and it's also a superfood, as you mentioned, with all those amazing essential fatty acids.
Yeah, salmon is absolutely great. Yeah. Okay, so
I have a few salmon recipes in the book because of my love of salmon.
Yes, and one of the issues that I think is important, just looking at fish before we get to the recipe, is that. Different types of fish taste good. People who say I don't eat fish often haven't tried fish, haven't eaten in the right way, haven't tried different textures of fish. In my house, fish was synonymous with smelt. And when I say the word smelt, I immediately sort of wiggle my nose and think, uh-huh. I don't want to have anything but salmon. This is great. So Southwestern Salmon Burgers, start out with 1 pound of skinless salmon fillet. So it's a fillet that people buy. What kind of salmon do you buy?
I buy wild salmon. And, you know, depending on the season, it could be king, coho, or whatever. But I always buy wild salmon. I really avoid farm salmon. And it doesn't matter if it's, like, fresh, you know, off an airplane, which is obviously less environmentally sound to purchase, or one that's been pre-frozen, which is much more environmentally sound. But the wild salmon is the key for me.
Okay. And getting back to that, so we can make this with frozen salmon or fresh salmon, because that's a big issue. Usually frozen salmon is cheaper than fresh salmon. Always look at a price with things. Then, after that, we're going to use 3/4 cup of blanched almond flour. Now, I have to tell you, I'm not familiar with almond flour. Where do you get it? I've never seen it. And what is it?
Almond flour actually is just ground blanched almonds that are then strained through a sieve so that they're very, so that you end up with like a fine, it's almost a dust, just like flour is almost a dust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes the recipe.
So it's almost got a pastry flour texture to it.
It's
almost
wonderful.
A pastry flour texture, which is good. And of course, when you're on a gluten-free diet, it's wheat that we have to avoid because we basically have antibodies that have developed to wheat. So 2 large eggs that we use, 2 large eggs, okay.
Exactly.
1 red bell pepper diced into 1/4-inch cubes.
Yep.
Okay, red bell pepper diced. 1 tablespoonful of mixed fresh cilantro. People love cilantro. People are neutral about cilantro. People hate cilantro.
Uh-huh.
So I always say cilantro to taste.
Uh-huh.
Cilantro to taste. And for my recipes, if I don't use cilantro, I use parsley, which also has, doesn't, of course, have the same exact issue, but it has the same green and texture.
That's great.
1 tablespoonful of finely chopped scallions. Okay. 1 teaspoon of sea salt. 1 teaspoon of ground cumin. I often buy my cumin at Asian grocery stores. I find it's cheaper, especially Indian grocery stores, Mexican grocery stores. Cumin that I buy in the supermarket tends to cost about 3 or 4 times as much as in Asian and Hispanic grocery stores. A teaspoon of ground chipotle. So you mean the chipotle chili in the can, the ground, or the sauce that's around it?
Ground chipotle in, like you said, in a Mexican supermarket or a Latin American supermarket, and also at the health food store and in a lot of grocery stores. But all it is ground up chipotle peppers that are put into, that turn into a powder.
Basically. And then a powder that are dried. So they give it a really nice taste.
Delicious.
1 tablespoon of freshly squeezed lime juice. Do not use concentrated lime juice. It doesn't taste the same.
You know,
I mean, there is no doubt about it. And then grapeseed oil. Why do you use that? We're using 2 tablespoons.
I use grapeseed oil. You could also use olive oil in this recipe easily. Grapeseed oil doesn't have the low burning point that olive oil has, so it's great for using in recipes where you're sautéing and frying. And then I use it throughout my book in place of butter. If you look at my chocolate chip cookie recipes and all my dessert recipes, whenever there's a need for some kind of butter or oil, I use grapeseed. Because it mimics the flavor of butter and has a more neutral taste than olive oil.
Yeah, olive oil does not have a neutral taste.
Yeah, you don't want to use that in dessert.
So we'll make the recipe. Rinse the salmon, pat it dry, cut into 1/4-inch cubes. Then in a large bowl, combine the salmon, almond flour, eggs, bell pepper, cilantro, if you're going to use it, scallion salt, cumin, chipotle powder, and lime juice. Form the mixture into 2-inch patties, and then heat the grapeseed oil in a large skillet over medium-high heat. Cook the patties for 4 to 6 minutes per side until golden brown. Transfer the patties to a paper towel lined plate so that the oil will ooze out of it, and serve it hot. I love it. It's got 361 calories. Most importantly, when we look at it, it's 62% of the protein that you need from the day from 1 calorie. This is a high-protein recipe, and when we look at fat, even though it's got roughly 35% of the fat you need for the day, it's good fat. There's good oil and bad oil, and clearly omega-3 fatty acids are good oil. It sounds like a delicious recipe that's high-protein. How do your kids like it?
Love it. And it's funny because when you were talking about the smelt and how people feel about fish, my children don't like to eat just plain broiled salmon. But if I jazz it up with these different ingredients like the scallions and cumin and lime juice, it tastes, the salmon and fish flavor is much more subtle. So I'm always trying to find new fun ways to prepare salmon for them.
Now, what's a good thing to serve with this?
Oh, I would serve it with steamed kale or broccoli or a big salad. And I think it's really important in our family that usually half the meal is just greens. I just think we don't eat enough greens in this day.
Absolutely. And the darker the green, the darker the green, the more nutrients we have in it. Thank you so much.
I think
this is great. We're going to have you back on our pledge show to maybe give us something delicious and sweet.
Maybe those chocolate cookies that you
I love chocolate cookies.
Thank you so much, you guys.
Thanks,
thanks for now,
and we'll see you later. To get a copy of today's recipe or to find out more about Alana's book and links to her blog, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for a weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
Our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener with us in Amelia Islands, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
I have a severe allergy to red meat, especially venison, beef, and lamb. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if there is anything that I can take to alleviate that anaphylactic shock reaction other than Zantac, which I take routinely.
What exactly happens when you eat red meat?
Hours later, I get severe hives. My tongue swells. My throat starts to close. My blood pressure drops out. I have to have epinephrine or I'll be kicking the bucket.
Oh, you really get sick from this. So you can't eat any red meat at all.
If I go to a restaurant and maybe they've, or a deli, and they have cut red meat and then they cut my turkey on top of it, I come home, I eat it, I look like I've had a bad Botox experience because my lips and my eyes swell.
I just swelled up. Yeah, that's a serious allergy, almost like a peanut allergy. What's your doctor say, by the way?
Well, he actually took my blood. He sent me to a lab. They took the blood. They shipped it to California, and they sent me a record back of how high my immune reaction was.
IgE reaction.
Right, my IgE, exactly. And it was just way over the top of very high on venison and beef.
Well, venison may not, I mean, venison is the most, is not the most common red meat that we have, and lamb is pretty unusual. Really, beef is the issue. First of all, let me assure you, there's no way that you can be desensitized to this. And so you've got a serious problem, and you have to stay away from red meat. The issue having to do with venison, lamb in our society, we don't eat a lot of lamb. We don't eat a lot of venison. You may want to eat it. Put it off to the side. I mean, it's unusual when you go to a deli that they're going to be slicing venison and lamb. I mean, that's an unusual deli. But it isn't unusual where they're actually slicing beef and the proteins may actually be on there. So you're limited in what you can do. And it's just like people with a severe wheat allergy who have celiac disease or people who have, wheat intolerance or have a peanut allergy. You just have to be, super careful. That's literally all you can do. So you can't go to a deli and have them slice turkey for you. You have to actually buy turkey in a chunk form and slice it at home. Yes. That's just what you have to do. Especially if you get these reactions where your face swells up. That's a potentially life-threatening reaction. Yeah.
What about niacin? I know it opens up all your blood vessels.
No, niacin isn't going to do anything. Niacin is not. Okay. It's not going to. We use it for cholesterol lowering. It causes flushing. It's not going to do anything for the allergy. Now, taking antihistamines such as Benadryl, which will make you sleepy, it's a good, great antihistamine. But taking one or two Claritin, for instance, taking 20 milligrams of over-the-counter generic Claritin, and adding to that Zantac can actually be somewhat helpful for you if you're going to not eat red meat, but you're going to have some deli meat and you're concerned about it. But if you're going to have red meat, you're going to want to do it in an environment where you're in your allergist or your doctor's office and you try a little red meat and they've got adrenaline right there to see if you're allergic. you know, but it sounds to me like you're allergic and you have to stay away from it. It's a potentially big problem, and there's, to my knowledge, there's no desensitization that can occur. So that's out of your diet, and so is deli slicing. Sorry.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. It's a serious, it's a potentially very, very serious problem, and food allergies cause a lot of disease and cause death in this country. So good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you for calling. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Before the break, Zorba, let's take a quick question from Michael in Mount Horeb, Wisconsin. Michael apparently loves his pepper and wants to know if there's any harm in eating too much pepper.
I don't think so. I mean, there's no evidence. We now know pepper doesn't cause ulcers. Mm-hmm. We know ulcers are caused by aspirin and anti-inflammatories, and they're caused by infections with something called H. pylori. We know that hot, spicy food does not cause ulcers. You know, for some people, they get dyspepsia. They don't feel good in their stomach. But no, you can eat all the pepper you want to. Pepper is safer than salt.
Mm-hmm. Are there any benefits to eating a lot of pepper?
Food tastes better.
Hey, yes, it does. Well, there's no harm in sending us too many emails with lifestyle questions, so send them to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research coming up, more of your questions, and our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have listeners on the phone, but an open line for you at 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, before our next call, problems going into the hospital and how we can alleviate them.
Right. One of the main issues that we have, and it's a huge financial issue, is complications of being in the hospital, which include rehospitalizations. And the estimate is that this is 10 to 15, maybe even 20% of the Medicare budget. It is a great big giant issue. Mm-hmm. And there are lots and lots of infections, lots and lots of deaths that occur because of this. And this particular study looked at the bacteria the patients bring when they come into the hospital. Let's put that on one part of this equation. In other words, what do you bring in?
Yeah.
And it turns out lots of people have bacteria in their nose and on their skin. And these are often strep and staph, very common bacteria, especially in the nose, were often carriers. And so this particular study, they had people, they swabbed their nose before they went into the hospital. It was about a week before they went in. Those who had a positive swab put an ointment in their nose, a special antibiotic ointment mm-hmm. called Bactrobam. It's not an over-the-counter ointment. Did it for 5 days. And then they looked at those who did it and those who didn't. And lo and behold, those who actually had their bacteria count decreased or cured by putting this ointment in their nose before they went in the hospital were less likely to have an infection in the hospital. Mm-hmm. But overall, hospital infections are a great big giant issue, and they cause lots of deaths, and we're attending to it, but we're way behind the ball.
Well, what kinds of things should hospitals be doing?
Hand washing. Hand washing is a big issue. You'd think that every doctor washes their hands between patients, but the answer is they don't. And it's an issue for every hospital, from a teaching hospital to a community hospital. Now, with soapless cleansers that are now around and in use, where you put a swab on it on your hand, they're much more palatable to people to washing their hands 3 or 4 times a day. The sink is not always easy to get to, and hand washing is still the number one and number two issue. The other issue is patients who know what they're going into the hospital for and paying attention to what's going on in the hospital are much more likely to get better care. If you have an advocate for you when you're going into the hospital, that's important. Why? Drugs are often stopped. They're often missed, especially since people are often not on the electronic medical record, and that produces a complication. But this also shows that maybe some pre-hospital work is very, very important.
Yeah.
Hospitals are my old mentor, Bob Mendelsohn, used to say, hospitals are cesspools of disease. They have infections in them, and it's true. Bacteria often live in the hospital.
Yeah. Well, you're saying we're not doing a good job.
We can do a better job. One of the issues with this study shows we should look at patients before they go in the hospital and test them to make sure they're not carrying bacteria. That's important. But the other part of it is we've got to make sure that doctors, nurses, and other personnel wash their hands. And if a doctor touches you and you haven't seen them wash your hands, say, doctor, please wash your hands.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Tom and Dr. Zorba.
How can we help?
Well, my questions are about osteoporosis. Does caffeine inhibit the absorption of calcium? So when I take the 600 milligrams of calcium and vitamin D with my coffee, am I not absorbing the calcium, or is the calcium, or is the caffeine leaching the calcium from my bones?
Yeah, I don't really think there's any hard evidence for that. You know, it's very interesting. First of all, if we look at calcium for osteoporosis, we'd love to say, yeah, get 1,800 milligrams a day and you won't develop osteoporosis. And the answer is no. You can get your 1,500, 1,800 milligrams a day and still develop osteoporosis. But we know that if you don't get calcium, the risk is greater. So in other words, we tell people to take calcium because we know not having enough increases the risk. Unfortunately, though, having enough doesn't decrease the risk. In other words, if you're going to get it, if it's inherited, if you're a thin, white, smoking woman, or of course, you need other medications such as Fosamax to actually help you and help keep your bones strong. But on the absorption point of view, I don't think there's really any evidence for that. So my recommendation is 1,500 to 1,800 milligrams a day whenever you can remember to take it. I mean, that's part of the issue. Now, do you take calcium chews or calcium tablets?
The tablets.
You know, a lot of people also get their calcium either through milk or dairy products. Think about it. Milk has lots of calcium. So why would cream interfere with calcium that you're taking with your coffee, right? I mean, why would the caffeine? I mean, we often put it in there. But on the other hand, you're not getting much calcium out of the cream you put in your coffee because,
right.
I mean, unless you're having half coffee and half of that. So I think you can enjoy your coffee and know that if you take enough calcium, it's a useful thing to do. And whenever you can take it, that's really the issue, whenever you can remember it.
Oh, okay.
So good luck to you, and thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
We appreciate it. Thank you very much. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, let's get to our medical mythbuster now. We have a listener myth today from Chuck in O'Fallon, Missouri. Chuck wants you to clear up a myth for him about the health benefits of massage. He writes, "Some claim this has positive health effects. Others say it's just feel good. My wife claims that she has Charlie horses and that the massage does wonders. Others claim it relieves stress. What is the truth about massage?"
The truth about massage is, A, it does make you feel good. That's why people do it. And B, it has health benefits. There's no doubt about it. Both are true. If your massage doesn't feel good, it's the wrong massage therapist. So that's number one. How do you find the appropriate massage therapist, certified massage therapist, is it should feel good and it shouldn't hurt. So where does the benefit come from? Well, for a lot of people, it relieves muscle soreness when they have the pain, for instance, of fibromyalgia or the pain of a sports injury. In labor, when people are in labor, it also reduces labor pain. It makes it better. There's some studies that show that premature babies, when they are massaged, reduce the number of days that they're actually in the hospital. Children are more likely to actually stay on their diabetic regime, young children, if they have massage. Cancer treatment, it helps often people feel good. They feel better even if they're on chemotherapy. And self-esteem, for some people who are especially lonely and living alone, they go to a massage therapist, and it's the only person who touches them. Mm-hmm. It's the only person who touches them. Touch is a very important part of human contact. And having another person actually touch you, it actually can make you feel good and have self-esteem, and that's good for your health. So there are lots of benefits to massage. It's not baloney. It's good health.
Do you do massages?
Absolutely, absolutely. I have a massage therapist. I have about three or four. I now find one that I find very useful. I go probably 6 to 10 times a year when my back really bothers me. I go to this massage therapist, and he's awesome. You know, whatever he does, I don't know. I've used probably 20 different massage therapists, and I found one that's perfect for me. It's very individual.
I've done it a few times. I'm not comfortable with massage.
Well, that's what makes life interesting, isn't it?
If you want Zorba to massage the kinks out of another myth, just send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, our number. And a listener now, Zorba, in Bonners Ferry, Idaho. Hi.
Tom, Dr. Zorba's pleasure.
How can we help?
Well, about 2 years ago, while I was driving down the road, a sharp, high-pitched ringing began in my left ear, and I could no longer hear anything from that left side. I went to a hearing specialist, and I found that I had lost 70% of my hearing in that side. He prescribed an anti-inflammatory med and said that I had sudden hearing loss and tinnitus, and he basically said good luck because he said there was no help for me. Since that time, my hearing has partially returned, except for the high-frequency ringing. It's just never subsided, and I have lost some of my high-end hearing abilities. And mostly of all, I can't hardly hear anything in a crowd. If I go into a restaurant, I'm just practically deaf.
Now, your hearing was fine, and all of a sudden, this just happened?
All of a sudden, I had perfect hearing, and then bang, just as if you flipped a switch.
Right. Unfortunately, sudden hearing loss is often irreversible, and it can be for a variety of reasons. I mean, it can be something from a stroke to unknown, you know, which means that, you know, idiopathic, where we don't know exactly what happens, because there are things that happen to the cochlea that simply it stops working. And sometimes it comes back, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it's associated with dizziness and so on. So we have to look at what you can do to make things better. You'll notice that certain restaurants, when you're hearing impaired, are better than others. And so you have to actually limit yourself to the restaurants you go to. Now, that's not limiting in life. You know, we go to certain restaurants for food that we like, certain restaurants because we like the ambiance or we like the environment, we like the chairs that we're sitting at. And basically, part of what you're going to think of in a restaurant is whether or not you can hear well or not. And restaurants, you know, with hard walls that don't have enough soundproofing are restaurants that are noisier. When you're in a restaurant, I'd recommend that you go into a corner, you ask for a corner table, and basically, you face the corner because you'll tend to get less noise that comes in with a corner than you will in the middle of an entire restaurant. And that's part of an issue that helps you attend to this hearing loss that you have.
What about a hearing aid?
Well, and that's the other issue. The hearing aid can be very useful. Have you tried a hearing aid at all?
I haven't. I've been resisting that.
Yeah. Why?
The vanity, probably.
Yeah.
More than anything, I've just been hopeful that at some point I could find some sort of, holistic cure of some kind that would help eliminate some of the ringing.
The ringing can be an issue. There is no holistic cure for the ringing. The ringing comes and it goes. It bothers people at some times, usually when it's quiet versus other times. Having some music on or something in the background allows our brain to attend to that sound and not attend to the ringing that's in the ear. Having a quiet whooshing sound, white noise, or the sound of an ocean when you go to sleep, it can help people. And so if you look, you know, at tinnitus, and we'll put some on our website, zorbapastor.org, it'll give you some tips. We'll give you some tips on what to do for the ringing. So the ringing, that's how you attend to it. It will be there forever. It'll bother you on and off. It may get worse, but it may stay the same, and most people over time adjust to it. Getting back to the vanity issue.
Yeah.
It's a function of whether or not you start to withdraw from social situations. If you withdraw from social situations because of your hearing loss, that's the time to get it.
Can do.
Okay, well, appreciate the
call.
Good
luck, and sorry I don't have a holistic answer. You go to the web, you'll find 10 million things. Nothing is proven to improve the hearing.
I don't know if you remember, Zorba. You know, most people who have hearing aids have them in kind of a skin color so they don't stand out.
Yes.
You and I couple of years ago were at a station-related social situation where a guy had hearing aids which were red.
Yes,
and
I remember that.
It was almost as though it was sort of a jewelry thing.
Like. Yes, that is right. That is. It was almost a jewelry thing.
So
that's exactly it.
Whatever
my hearing
works
aid.
For you.
Absolutely. I do remember that.
Well, before we leave for the week, Zorba, we have a question for you and the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police. Mika in Knoxville, Tennessee states that something you said stirred up a question in him about language. He writes, on a recent show, you mentioned that it's sometimes difficult to speak correct English without sounding wooden. Is there a correct but not wooden sounding answer to the question, how are you? I believe that the grammatically correct answer is, I'm well. But this sounds overly formal to my ear. However, I'm sometimes loath to respond, I'm good, which sounds overly informal to my ear. It's all well and good to argue for speaking correctly or for speaking colloquially, but in this case, I'm not really happy with either choice. Is there a middle ground?
Well, there is a middle ground. The middle ground is, because I've thought about this as a physician, I go, how you doing? And people go, fine.
Yeah.
Well, they've come into my office. They're not fine. It's not, they're not actually asking a question. It's a greeting. That's all it is. Hi, how you doing? I'm fine. How are you? And the greeting is, the grammar goes out the window because it's not a grammatical construction. I mean, there's really not grammar involved. It's a greeting like Salam Aleichem. They're just greetings in society. How you doing? Fine, man. And the greeting also is the texture of the greeting, because I've thought about it, is a function of age. So, you know, I go into the office and somebody is 20, I go, how you doing? They go, hey, man, great. How are you? And then we go on to what the real substance of the conversation is. So if people say, hello, how are you? And you go, I'm well, they assume that you're asking how they're actually doing physically. I don't think that's what they're asking. I think they're just going, hi. And it's an extension of that.
Yeah. I use well all the time.
How you doing? Well, how are you? Well, maybe it is. Huh? Yeah. Maybe I'm well.
In any
case, we'll go on to the end, but good luck on figuring it out.
Well, if you have suggestions for Mika, send them in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Take care, Tom, and stay well.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lenny and Squiggy, also known as Adam Friedrich and Brad Kohlberg, are the two guys on the other end of the dumbwaiter responsible for this hour. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0205Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.